STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Well, good to talk to you today. This is Jim Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel here at the Stand to Reason radio show. And as you know, he's usually here every time about this time of the week, but he's away traveling today. So I'll be sitting in for him, trying to my best to do some basic training for your mind, as we typically do here at Stand to Reason, where we talk about the critical issues of life, of ethics, values, and religion. So I just wanted to start off today. Well, the second hour, we've got a great guest coming. Alex Chediak has written a book called Preparing Your Teens for College that's published by Tyndale. And so, for example, if you're somebody who's a parent who has teens, this is of kind of utmost importance. But a lot of what we're going to be talking about in the second hour is stuff that really starts early as a parent. So if you've got kids of any age, this would be a good time to kind of get ready to talk about the things that are necessary so we can prepare our students, our Christian students particularly, as they get ready to enter college. Alex Chediak in the second hour. In this first hour, I want to talk a little bit, just opening up here, and I will be available for your phone calls. So give us a call at 855-243-9975. Outside the United States, area code 562-424-8229. So if you're listening and want to get in the queue, now is the time to call. But as a matter of fact, I want to talk about something that we typically do when we go to college. I mean, those of us who have been to university probably take some of that time and use it to kind of think about what it is we were raised with as Christians. Do we believe it? Is it of value to us? Are there other religious worldviews that might be more accurate? Is a secular atheist worldview make a more accurate view of the world? And sometimes we examine these questions for the first time in our university experience. And so I wanted to start off today just talking about why I think that even if you are a religious seeker, you're somebody who is not quite sure what to make of the nature of the world. You're kind of wondering if God has a role in the nature of the world. Is theism true? And if you're seeking and looking in those at those issues, I do think Christianity is the best place to start. And I make that offer not because I think as a kind of a biased Christian, I'm simply picking for the home team. I think there are good reasons, especially when you see how much a part of every other religious worldview Jesus happens to be. It's not just Christianity that has a view of Jesus in sight. Pretty much every major world religion has something to say about the person of Jesus. So I don't think it's really a bold assertion in and of itself to say that we should start with Christianity, because this happens to be, I think, the one religious leader, Jesus, who's most frequently mentioned by other religious groups, whether or not they even happen to be Christian. So let me just kind of review with you some of the ways that other religious worldviews see Jesus. How do they describe Jesus? You'd be surprised to see the respect that is typically paid by others when considering the person of Jesus. For example, in Judaism, now, of course, as we know, Christianity is born and birthed and actually comes out of Judaism, but Jews for the last 2,000 years had a chance to think about who Jesus is. It's not just that Christianity is tied to Judaism historically. It's that Judaism has had 2,000 years to evaluate the claims of Christ. And it's interesting to see how they see Jesus, and especially in the most ancient documents written about Jesus. And a lot of this stuff we're going to have to find in sources like the Talmud or the Taladot Yeshu. And as we look at these sources, some of which are, I guess, late if you were to look at them in terms of the early dating of the Gospels, the Talmud, the Taladot Yeshu are somewhere from 500 to 1,000 years after the fact. But most religious Jews believe these documents contain information that's been handed down accurately from the first century. So the ideas we see represented in these documents ought to be a somewhat accurate reflection of what was believed early on, at least maybe in the first 300 years, 400 years after the fact, which is still relatively early to see how these folks processed claims about Jesus. So for example, you will see in the Taladot Yeshu that Jesus is acknowledged as the son of Mary. The ancient Jews made this claim. They believed that he existed, number one. That he had a mother named Mary. Now, they denied that Mary was a virgin when she conceived Jesus. But they did recognize that Mary was promised to a man named Yohanan. So if you read the Taladot Yeshu, you'll see claims some of which are quite pejorative related to Jesus, because they were, I'll talk more about that in a minute, but many of which, in order to be a dismissing of Jesus, have to admit reluctantly certain key details about the person of Jesus. So you'll see in the Tal.Yeshu that it'll say that near his house dwelt a widow and her lovely and chaste daughter named Miriam. Miriam was betrothed to Yohanan, the royal house of David. So here Joseph is recognized in the lineage of David. It says, a man learned in the Torah and God-fearing. On the eighth day he was circumcised. When he was old enough, the lad was taken by Miriam to the house of study to be instructed in the Jewish tradition. So you see the Tal.Yeshu actually acknowledges Mary and Joseph, and that some key details related to Jesus, including the fact that he was taken to study and be instructed in the Jewish tradition. Not only that, you'll see that the earliest claims of Jewish believers do acknowledge Jesus as a teacher, as a rabbi, a popular teacher, although they would deny he is the Messiah, of course. And you'll even see in the most ancient forms of either the Talmud or the Tal.Yeshu that Jesus is said to have many disciples, including some of the key names like Matthias or Matthew, being recognized by the earliest Jewish documents related to Jesus. He's obviously respected in these documents also. Now, if you think about this, sometimes you'll see in the Tal.Yeshu, for example, which is going to come out about 1,000 years after the fact as the earliest copy we have. There you'll see that Jesus is often derided in some way, and it's not unusual to see that continue to this day. But this was not the case in the earliest of times. So if you're going to search for negative material related to Jesus in the first and second century Jewish literature, you're going to have a hard time finding it, because he is generally recognized as a popular teacher who is revered by his followers, respected by his opponents. But, of course, as Christianity began to take root and spread and was being proclaimed throughout the known world, you did see a rise in Jewish opposition. So by 1000 AD, about the time we have the earliest copy of the Tal.Yeshu, you are seeing that Jewish believers are facing some pretty stiff persecution and blamed a lot of their situation on the rise of Christianity and the person of Jesus. So we do see some negative comments being made. But you do see in these ancient documents, the Talmud documents, for example, and the Tal.Yeshu, that Jesus is identified as a miracle worker. So the most ancient Jewish followers who were familiar with the story of Jesus never denied his miraculous power. They acknowledged he had supernatural powers. They acknowledged that he performed miracles. Now, they typically denied that this power came from God. But the idea that Jesus was a miracle worker was accepted and recognized in the earliest Jewish documents. That Jesus, quote, practiced magic and led Israel astray is found in the Talmud. Something very similar, for example, are talked about how the people marveled at his miraculous feats in the Tal.Yeshu. And you'll see in these old ancient documents like the Tal.Yeshu that Jesus claimed to be the Messiah. This is not something – sometimes you'll hear people argue that the Christian scriptures, Jesus never claimed to be God. Well, that doesn't appear to be the claim of the earliest Jewish believers who called him out as somebody who did claim to be not only the Messiah. And they acknowledged that he made this claim publicly. You see this in the earliest writings of Jewish believers. You also see in these writings, in both the Talmud and the Tal.Yeshu, that Jesus was crucified on the cross. This is a claim of the New Testament, obviously, but it's also acknowledged in these ancient Jewish records. They may deny, for example, that he was resurrected, but the idea that he was executed on the cross is affirmed in both of those ancient documents. As a matter of fact, another claim that's affirmed in these documents is that the followers of Jesus reported at least that he rose from the dead, although they would deny that this actually happened, that the report from the disciples is affirmed, for example, in the Tal.Yeshu, which tries even to explain the empty grave by saying that a gardener removed Jesus' body. So you have very early claims by Jewish believers that have to deal with the empty tomb. So this is yet another piece of evidence we would look at. Some people, for example, today, I think the most recent version of Bart Ehrman's claims in how Jesus became God, is that there is no empty tomb to have to reconcile. That, in fact, in order for the theory that he's promoting today to work, he's now shifted to say, well, Jesus never received a proper burial at all. But you do have early Jewish documents that claim not only that the tomb was empty, but they try to offer a way to explain the empty tomb. Now, that's just the one worldview, one religious worldview, and what it has to say about Jesus. And of course, you might say, well, come on, this is kind of a cousin worldview to Christianity. But you would, of course, expect to say something about Jesus. But Islam also has a lot to say about Jesus. Founded by Muhammad in the Arabian Peninsula in the early 7th century, here you've got claims. I mean, don't forget, Muhammad claimed to be restoring the monotheistic religion that was corrupted by the Jews and the Christians. But as a result of this, you see that Muslims, for the most part, will acknowledge the impact of Jesus. They'll recognize him in some significant way in their own writings and within their own religious system, given what's written in the Quran. So this idea that Jesus was born of a virgin, well, the Quran actually describes Mary as a virgin prior to her miraculous conception. And the conversation they would paint between Allah and Mary, it's recorded in the Quran. And in this recorded conversation, Mary is told that she will conceive without the benefit of human involvement. So this idea that Jesus is born of a virgin is something that's embraced in Islam. In fact, the idea that Jesus was to be revered is also embraced in Islam. He's held in very high regard in the Muslim worldview. According to a legend in Islam, Muhammad, when he eliminated all the images of other gods in the Kaaba, he refused to destroy the statue of Mary and the infant Jesus. Jesus remains, even to this day, in a position of respect, in a position of reverence within Islam. When Muslims, for example, speak in the name of Jesus today, they typically say Hazrat Es Isa, which means revered Jesus, or they'll express him in some way such as Jesus, peace be upon him. This idea, this kind of titles that are given to Jesus within Islam really reflect the way he is revered as a prophet, as an apostle of God, even though they don't believe he was any more than that. So this idea that he may not be God in Islam, of course, but he is to be revered into this theistic worldview. He's also embraced as a prophet in Islam, known as Isa or Isa, one of God's most important prophets. You'll see him described in this way. He's actually acknowledged as being specifically sent as a prophet to the children of Israel. And while Muhammad is described as the final prophet from God, he lists all the previous prophets, and he includes Jesus in that list. So Muslims believe Jesus was a prophet, even though they deny he is God. They place him in a position of reverence. And of course, they do deny that he is the Son of God, but they see him also as a very wise teacher, a divinely wise teacher. The Quran says that Jesus' disciples, as a result of what they taught or learned, they learned from Jesus, were filled with compassion and mercy as a result of his teaching. The Quran also says the disciples were helpers of God, although, of course, they believe this God not to be Yahweh, but to be Allah. And Muslims actually acknowledge Jesus as a wise teacher who had many disciples. And they believe that the teaching of Jesus was actually limited by the will of Allah. They also believe that the disciples of Jesus, of course, identified themselves not as Christians, but they would say as Muslims. But this idea that Jesus is revered and that he is a wise teacher is embraced in Islam. How about the idea that Jesus is a miracle worker with the kind of supernatural aspect? Remember, most critics of the Bible or critics of any theistic system will argue against the supernatural, right? But this idea that Jesus is a miracle worker is not unique just to Christianity or even to Judaism. It's also in the Quran that Jesus performed many miracles, and those miracles included, for example, healing a blind man, healing a leper. They even, of course, will go beyond this. They'll actually describe the infancy of Jesus. And so from the perspective of the Quran, Jesus is acting and behaving miraculously from the time of being a baby all the way through his adult life. And it even says in the Quran that Jesus brought others back from the dead. So this idea that he could resurrect someone from the dead is affirmed in the Quran. And how about this? The idea that Jesus ascended into heaven. Pretty bold claim, but Islam actually acknowledges that Jesus ascended into heaven in bodily form. And it says that Jesus will sit beside Allah during the judgment. So Muslims acknowledge the ascension, And of course, they would deny that Jesus was crucified or that he died on the cross, but most simply believe that Jesus' death was an illusion of some sort. And some even, for example, believe that Judas was mistaken for Jesus on the cross. But the idea that Jesus ascended into heaven is affirmed in Islam. And how about the idea that Jesus is going to come back and return? Well, believe it or not, Islam acknowledges this, that Jesus will return in the future during the latter days. And the Hadith, which is a collection of sayings from Muhammad, describes the second coming of Jesus. So now, of course, they would maintain that Jesus will return as a Muslim and as a follower of Muhammad, returning to revive Islam. But the idea that Jesus will return is affirmed within Islam. How about Baha'i? This is another worldview, a religious worldview. If you know much about Baha'i, Baha'u'llah was a 19th century Persian who claimed to be a messenger of God, and he founded the Baha'i faith in 1863. Now, he taught that all of religious history had been revealed through a series of messengers, and these messengers had been sent by God. And he considered himself to be the least of all these messengers, but he did recognize several leaders from prior religious movements. And he claimed that these folks, these men, revealed a progressive truth of God to each generation in which they were sent as a messenger. So based on that, Baha'u'llah accepted many of the claims of Christianity. He affirmed many characteristics of Jesus, including that Jesus came from God. This, as a matter of fact, the Baha'i faith describes Jesus as a manifestation of God, and it acknowledges that Jesus was sent by God. Now, it does not place Jesus in any higher position. It places Jesus alongside other messengers from other religious movements like Abraham or Muhammad or Buddha or Krishna. These are kind of equal status to Jesus in the Baha'i faith. But the idea that Jesus was born of a virgin, for example, is also affirmed by the Baha'i faith, and that he spoke for God, yes, that's affirmed by Baha'i, and also that he was a wise teacher, that is also in the writings of Baha'u'llah, that he had a divine and human nature. Well, that's actually affirmed by Baha'u'llah also. He described the nature of Jesus, as a matter of fact, in a very consistent manner with the biblical teaching. And how about that he was a miracle worker? Yeah, as a matter of fact, the Baha'i faith acknowledges that Jesus performed a number of miracles, and even that he was crucified as an atonement for humanity. You see that also as a teaching of Baha'i. Even in Hinduism, Jesus is a holy man. Jesus is a wise teacher. Jesus is God. In Buddhism, Jesus is an enlightened man. He's a wise teacher. He's a holy man. Even in the New Age movement, believers would at least accept Jesus from the perspective of a wise, moral teacher, although it's really hard to kind of pin down precisely what New Age believers of one stripe or another might believe about Jesus. Most would at least offer you that. Now, here's why I bring all this up. Every one of these religious worldviews seems to have a view or something to say about Jesus. Jews believe that Jesus was Mary's son, was a teacher or rabbi, had many disciples, was respected, performed miracles, claimed to be the Messiah, was crucified on a cross. They also acknowledge his followers reported Jesus was raised from the dead. Muslims believe Jesus was born of a virgin, is to be revered and respected. He was a prophet, a wise teacher who worked miracles, who ascended to heaven and will come again. Baha'i believers believe that Jesus came from God, was a wise teacher who had divine and human nature, worked miracles, was crucified and resurrected as an atonement for humanity. Hindus believe he was a holy man, a wise teacher, and a God, and Buddhists believe that Jesus was an enlightened man and a wise teacher. So it seems to me, if you're on a search for truth related to God, that one good place to start is simply in the one religious worldview that has the most to say about the guy who seems to be so important to all the other religious worldviews, the guy who seems to be a common thread that runs through every other theistic worldview. That guy is Jesus, of course. And if you're inclined to begin a spiritual quest for truth, I think it would be wise to start with the faith system that best describes the man all other faith systems find themselves compelled to explain. Christianity is founded on a reliable record of this man God we know as Jesus. And it ought to be the first stop, it seems to me, in any seeker's journey of faith. All right, we'll stop right there. We'll come back after the break and take some questions. Call me at 855-243-9975. We'll be right back after this break at Stand to Reason.
You can take STR with you through our apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad, available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen live to STR's weekly webcast, to podcast archives by all of our STR speakers, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and much, much more. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. It's free, so download the app today through iTunes or the Android Market, and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Don't forget, Stand to Reason's live broadcast is Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. on the web. That's Pacific time, by the way. So go to STR.org to listen live or use your STR app to stream it live. You can also give me a piece of your mind by calling at that time, Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. Here's the number, 855-243-9975. And, of course, you can listen on the radio, like always, on Sundays, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific time. But for the live broadcast, tune in online Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time by going to str.org.
So good to be back with you here at Stand to Reason. Jim Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel. Try my best to contend for the Christian worldview. Talked a little bit in the last segment about why I think Christianity is a good place to start when examining theistic worldviews. Now we're going to go to a caller, Brandon, from Columbus, Ohio. Let me push our button here. And did I get you or did I lose you? Oh, you know what? I think I lost him. My fault. Brandon, give us a call back and we'll come back to you in a second. I know Brandon called to ask, does anyone have a right to die? And I think this is him now back on the phone. That's probably my fault, folks, so please forgive me, and we'll get you right back on. Here he is. So Brandon here on line one from Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Brandon, how are you?
I am great, sir. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for calling right back. I made a little basically operator error, my fault. So.
Oh, you know what? I didn't even have to get off the phone, so it's no big deal.
Okay, great.
Well, hey, so I've got a question for you. My wife is a critical care nurse, and she sees a lot of people die. And so we had an interesting discussion the other night about, does anyone have the right to die? You know, and there's a couple scenarios we were talking about. You know, we don't object to the cancer patient who, at the end of their life, refuses maybe the last round of treatment to go be comfortable with their family. You know, that person is electing to die, but so we don't have an objection with that, yet we do have an objection with ending someone's life because unsatisfied with the quality of their life or what have you in a hospital setting. And so I wanted to get your thoughts on, does anyone have the right to die? And maybe a related question would be, when does life end to where we have the right to help other people die? I wanted to get your kind of your thoughts on that.
A couple of good questions there. First of all, let's just talk about the issue of the idea that we make it to a point. And when you say that you're in a hospital setting and you're struggling with whether or not you want to continue to live, and you may not be in – it sounds like you're talking about a situation in which you're not terminal. You're just depressed or dissatisfied with the quality of life you have in the hospital. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that would be sort of the second scenario in which we do have an objection. There's something about that I think resonates and seems wrong.
Yeah.
Yet what doesn't seem wrong is when a person seems like they're nearing the end of their life, rejects treatment in order to die and be miserable. I'm just having a hard time kind of comparing those two scenarios. You know what I mean?
Sure. Now, a couple things. Let me just offer a couple of ideas as we go forward, because sometimes this is offered to me as kind of an objection to my view on abortion, for example, related to the aging. And this is not unusual to have this kind of objection leveled. So, for example, when I typically hear it, it's someone will say something like, how can you be comfortable ending the life of a person on life support, let's say, yet uncomfortable ending the life in the womb? Even if you accepted both of these things as being human life, you seem to have no problem turning the machine off. What's the difference here? And I think the difference is in what I would call not yet adult humans. We stand there human in the womb and never again adult humans. Let me kind of parse that out for a second. Even though fetal humans may lack brainwave activity in the womb, say that they're that young where they lack that kind of activity. If left to their own devices and we do nothing to intervene, and that, Brandon, is the key about intervention, they will eventually become fully functional human beings. So in essence, they're not yet adult humans, but they're human, but they're not yet adult humans. But if you simply leave them alone, fail to intervene, they're going to become humans like you and me. So, for example, the silly illustration I typically use is that, you know, you go to the market and you buy bananas, and most of the bananas you're going to buy at the market are pretty green because they're put on the shelves green because they know by the time you get them home, they're going to be ripe. You know, the next day they'll be less green. No one throws away green bananas because we know if you leave them alone, they will be ripe. They're bananas. Right now, when they're green, they're not yet ripe bananas. If you buy them, put them on the shelf, leave them alone, do nothing to intervene, they're going to become ripe bananas, and we all love ripe bananas. You don't throw away green bananas. Now, the never again adult humans, that's kind of what we're talking about when we're talking about somebody who sadly is in a position where they are tragically, terminally ill, just a short period of time away from dying. This is kind of like saying, well, this is very different than left on their own without any intervention. Their course is very different. The course of a not yet adult human left on their own without any intervention is to eventually become an adult. The course of a never again adult human, somebody who is dying of a terminal disease, is left alone without any intervention, they will cease to live altogether. So the issue then becomes, well, what? It's really about intervention. In both these situations, we would have to intervene in the one to end the fetal human and the other to extend the one who is dying. And so the question becomes, that's very different, of course, than somebody who's just dissatisfied with their medical condition or dissatisfied with their life in general, like a suicide issue. But I think in the end, it's all about intervention. I would not be comfortable intervening to expedite, speed up the death process. I don't think that's something we would want to do. But at the same time, I may not want to intervene to extend this process unduly. If I was just to kind of remove the intervention we offer as humans, let nature, or in this case, let God do what God does with all of us. As an atheist, I would have said, hey, it's just a natural course of living and dying unless we intervene. So the question here is about whether or not we intervene. I would say at this point, that's really the key issue. I would not intervene to extend, but I would probably be more than happy to stop intervening if that is going to expedite the termination of the loved one who really wants to be taken off the machine, wants it to end sooner. That's really about stopping the intervention rather than intervening unnaturally or in an ungodly way. We're going to stop intervening. Does that make sense, the difference there?
Yeah, that does make sense. And I agree it does come down to that intervention question. And I agree with you, but let me offer you a counter-argument for the heck of it.
Yeah, please.
So intervening, or maybe ceasing to intervene, is what's being said is morally acceptable.
Yes.
Imagine a quadriplegic who requires intervention to stay alive. Mm-hmm. They need someone to feed them in order for them to stay alive. So by ceasing their intervention of you feeding them, their body's going to take its natural course and die of starvation. So in that case, it seems like removing intervention is almost the unnatural thing.
Yeah, and the difference I think here, Brandon, is the request for intervention. So for example, intervention, if I'm going to get involved in your life and intervene in your life, Brandon, I'm only going to be able to do it if you ask me to intervene. To intervene in your life before you ask me is really that to me, you would probably resist that kind of intervention. Would you agree? If I said, I think you need to change your life in this way, so I'm going to intervene and change your life for you, you would say, oh, no, it's a request. There are folks who are willing to go into the combat field or go into law enforcement and put themselves in harm's way and actually sacrifice their lives. They don't want you to intervene to stop them from sacrificing because they believe it's the right thing to do. That's very different than somebody asking for the intervention. So here what you have is somebody asking, hey, just don't intervene. Just leave me alone and let this be between me and God. This is my situation. I've prayed. I've asked God for this, and God is going to do what God's going to do here. And I'm asking you to not intervene. That's very different than asking you to intervene, and then you would feel like, well, now, if after having been asked to intervene, I refuse to, that's a very different position to be in, don't you think?
So if you were taking care of me, and I told you, hey, Jim, stop feeding me. You know, I've settled this with the Lord. I think it's my time. I'd rather you not feed me anymore and just let me go, no matter what I say. That's my wish. You know, would you comply or would you not?
Yeah, when you said no matter what I say, I think what you're saying is, hey, I'm not, no matter what I say, I'm never going to ask you to intervene anymore. I'm telling you, I don't want your intervention. I've already prayed this out. I just want to be left here. I'm just going to close my eyes, and at some point, God's going to take me. Then I would say, okay, that's fine. That's between you and God. I'm no longer intervening when you've asked me not to.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really what it comes down to, is the request and then the idea of intervention. Those two things.
Sure.
So that's my perspective. And if anybody has kind of some input on that, I would love to hear it. Give us a call. We'll talk about it and just kind of bat this idea around. There's some great articles at the STR website, one called End of Life Ethics. You just need to get over there right away and read that, Brandon, because I think that'll kind of help sort you through. But I know there's more. There's a ton of stuff there. And I know that either Melinda or Amy will be linking to these things at the end of today's broadcast, so you can find better resources even at STR to kind of discuss this. Now, before I let you go, though, I'd like to talk a little bit about this idea of suicide, because I think that's one of those areas where it gets just the idea. And I when you first said it, I just had to kind of talk about it for a second. How many we often talk about this idea of depression and how we get to a place where we might feel suicidal. And I never want to negate the value of that. If someone feels that way, you never want to say, well, you shouldn't feel that way, or try to minimize their sense of desperation, their sense of depression. It wouldn't be fair. And so I never want to take that approach. But I do think there are some great examples in Scripture of folks in history who have really – they were godly men who really struggled with depression, with sadness, with confusion, sometimes that they felt they were completely alone. And you see examples. And so I just want to point out a few for anybody who might be kind of struggling with this themselves, just four people in particular. Moses, if you look at Numbers 11 and start in verse 14, you'll see that there are lots of times when Moses felt like he was too weak. He was too under-equipped. He was too inadequate to live a life that God really called him. How many times do you see, even when he's first called, it's like he's kicking and dragging, like he doesn't want to go. He doesn't want to do this. And he often felt the same way that I think that we feel, like we just don't measure up. We're not the person that God thinks we are. How could that even be, by the way? But the point is, Moses was able to overcome that. And able to kind of continue in his work, even though he did often, it seems to me, feel like he could do no more. He's just faithful. He trusted God to fill in the gaps in his strength. And I don't ever want to say, of course, that people who are suffering from depression are just not faithful enough. That's not my point. But you do see examples of someone like Moses who's able to – how about Elijah? He's overworked. He's exhausted. He's feeling like nothing really kind of makes a difference anymore. Nothing he's doing matters. You see that in 1 Kings 19. But then God speaks to Elijah, reminds him, man, you're not alone, knucklehead. And then all the triumphs and struggles, they don't go unnoticed by God. And so Elijah's life, once he realized it matters to God, he kind of moves through this period in his own life. And Job – here's a guy who suffered like – who else suffers as much as Job? Who else has more reason to be depressed than Job? He's under a spiritual attack on all sides. He loses everything. He loses his family. He loses his wealth. He even loses his health. Yet he holds fast to his love for God. What's I love about Job, especially in for folks I know who have struggled with depression, who always seem to go back to the book of Job for encouragement – is they find that one of the key aspects of Job kind of coming back to his senses is that Job continues to see his place in his worldview relative to an all-powerful, almighty God. And as he kind of does this in open dialogue with God, he's praying to God, he's talking to God, and he's being reminded by God, Job, you're not God, I'm God. This is happening a lot with Job. That has a powerful impact on his ability to sustain himself through a bad time. And I'll just end with Jonah, right? I mean, here's a guy who's about as rebellious and disobedient as any teenager I've ever raised. And, he doesn't want to do what God's calling him to do. And even when he steps off, and does what God wants him to do, doesn't he always seem like pouty, unhappy? He's always unhappy and grumpy, in a lot of ways. Look at Jonah 4. You'll see that Jonah's kind of a saddened kind of Eeyore character in some ways, But God, he kind of scolds Jonah the way that he scolds Job. And through all of this, you see that it's what makes the difference, it seems to me, in the lives of these four men is their incredible direct relationship with God, in which they are always in constant dialogue. Now, I know that wasn't exactly where you were going in this question, Brandon, but I do think in the end, I feel like that I want to encourage those. If you're in a terminal situation, you're asking us to stop intervening so I can just let this play out in the next few days, I get that. But if you're in a place where I'm just tired, I just think it's done. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I've known who have retired from law enforcement when all they needed was a good 5-week vacation, okay? Because they thought they were at the end of it. But they just needed a period of refreshing, and then they're ready to go again. And I think that for a lot of us, I just hope that we can move through these difficult times. And if we do, it's going to end up being on the basis of a relationship, I think, a close relationship with God. So.
Yeah, well, that's a good word, man. That's really good. Yeah, my wife is a critical care nurse. That's just such an awesome opportunity to talk to some of these people who are in the hospital, you know, some of them not that long, but some of them for years.
Yeah.
And they just want it to be over because they don't see a future for themselves. So.
Yeah, no.
Every night she comes home with stories of people she talked to and family members who she's just able to have an impact on. So,
yeah, you know, and I never want to minimize how they must, because you know it's hard for us, right, to put ourselves in that position and try to make any sense of that, right? It's hard for us to kind of think, well, you know, I never want to say, for example, I know what you're going through. No, I don't know what you. Even if I had been in that situation, what I went through may have been different than what they're going through. So I'm always really careful about not wanting to act like I have some sense of the pain of others. But I do have lots of folks in my family, for example, that have really struggled with depression over the years. And what I notice is that seems to be the most acute in those family members I have who have kind of stopped, if I'm honest, they've stopped reading their Bibles, they've stopped praying. Not that this is the case for everybody. There's lots of folks who are struggling with depression who are praying every day and want it to be lifted and can't understand why God's not taking care of it. But I do know that if we see examples through Scripture of those four men, for example, I do think that it's going to come through. You see, a tight relationship with God is – and your wife's probably experienced that too. I'll bet you when she does share with these folks who are suffering, it's always in the context of her Christian faith, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I think there is, and I do think that God uses these things. I'll tell you, without naming names, there have been a number of people who I have worked with in law enforcement who have been really amongst the most sarcastic and cynical of my friends. And there's a way in which, you know, Brandon, cynicism helps, you know, to survive difficult
sure,
situations.
Help you do it.
Yeah. And maybe your wife has kind of tried to struggle with that herself, but I can tell you that when they were really finally were shaken by a difficult situation, God used that to build the first steps in a relationship with Him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to. That's not. I never want to say, "Well, you should be a Christian, so it'll help you in some bad time." But there are many examples of folks who God has used a terrible time, a season in their life, to bring them closer to Him. So I think God does use these events. So
absolutely, yep.
All right, Brandon, thanks so much for calling in. I appreciate you doing that. I'll talk to you soon.
Hey, you guys, and I'm just so thankful for Stand to Reason. I just wanted to put in a plug because I recently became a strategic partner and just want to encourage those who are listening, if there's a wiser place to put your money, let me know.
Yeah, no kidding.
Stand to Reason's just it's meant so much to me, and so I really appreciate you guys.
Oh, I really appreciate you saying that. If you go to our website, too, people can go and see that we've got a link at the bottom of the website on the homepage that'll help you to see, and also to kind of assess what is the role of strategic partners in a ministry like this. They are critical, and that's what gives us longevity. It's why you're listening to this radio show today is because people have thought it important enough to become a strategic partner. So, Brandon, I really appreciate you saying that.
Absolutely.
All right,
have a great night, brother.
All right, thanks. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. We'll take a little break right here at this point in our broadcast since we are right at the mark for our first break, and we'll come back. And I'm looking forward to hearing your phone calls. Got open lines right now, 855-243-9975, right here on Stand to Reason.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to iDonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org. Or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
Great to be back with you here. Jim Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason, where we try to give you a piece of our mind as we speak to you every week about this time. Greg's traveling today, so I'm sitting in for him, trying my best to contend for the Christian worldview here on our weekly radio show. You know, this last weekend, we had a chance to speak at a kind of a cool event down in Imperial with Brett and Alan, and I drove down there and did a whole day training. And a couple of observations from that event I just wanted to share with you. A couple of things. Number one, if you've not heard Alan's talk on homosexuality, it's really worth listening to it. And I can tell you, just sitting at the back of the room, there's a real discomfort within Christendom about some of these topics. And we need to be really careful that we don't let our discomfort silence us in our responsibility to train up the next generation. We have good foundation as Christians and a good evidence trail within the Bible and really from the science that's being done in the culture today to make a case. And as I sat in the back of the room and kind of, you know, it's kind of like when you watch and you're in a jury trial and you're at the prosecutor's table, you know, I'm listening carefully to the testimony of everyone involved. But I really am spending a lot of time, if I'm honest with you, watching the jury to kind of see, you know, how they're accepting what we're doing, what they're, you know, is there somebody who's kind of shaking his head? Is there somebody who's nodding his head? You know, these are kinds of things you're looking for. And I'm sure the other side is doing the exact same thing. But as I'm sitting at the back of the room during a presentation, I'm looking to see, you know, how uncomfortable are we with what I think is the wedge issue that needs to be addressed within the church? I mean, that's really where it has to happen. And it turns out that I did see some discomfort in the room, and that's a shame. And I think this is a very important topic. I was glad to be a small part of it. At the end of this talk, the whole day of talks, and I did mine on biblical reliability, and Brett did his on the problem of evil, there were folks who had questions, and we had a Q&A session. And I got to tell you, afterwards, we answered a few questions. We had some time to do that. But there were folks who came up to me, one person in particular, who said, Jim, I couldn't even begin to raise my hand to ask questions because I have so many unanswered questions. They're just – the more I look at Christianity, the larger the number of unanswered questions, the larger my concerns kind of grow because it seems like the more I learn, the more I need to learn. The more I know, the more I know I don't know. You know, this dilemma we see, right? Well, I do think it's easy. The essential truths are easier to identify from Scripture. But there are just a ton of non-essentials and more ambiguous features of Christianity. And that's – for a lot of folks, that's hard to accept. And it seems to be something that they'll struggle with.
the kind of unfathomable aspect of God's nature. That does leave us in awe. It leaves us many times without an adequate explanation. And I think to make matters worse, that the kind of ancient claims, the historical details that are described in the New Testament, they're just, if you think about it, they're so remote to our everyday experience, and they're so hard, it seems, for a lot of people to try to accurately verify. And so I think for a lot of folks end up with questions in places where they would rather have clarity. They'd rather have evidential certainty, but they now have unanswered questions. Well, let me just offer a little piece of advice here as a cold case detective. Get comfortable with unanswered questions, because I've never investigated a case. I've never examined a case or presented a case in front of a jury that wasn't plagued with a number of unanswered questions. And if you think you can't make a decision unless every possible question is answered, well, one thing for sure, you'll never serve on a criminal jury. And you'll never be comfortable with any worldview you hold. Even as an atheist, there were a number of critical questions that I had from my materialistic, naturalistic worldview that I simply couldn't answer. How does the universe originate? You know, why does it appear to be fine-tuned? How does life begin in this universe? How does biology, why does it even have appearances of design? How do we get to immaterial mind through a material process? You know, how do I explain free will, objective moral truth? There's lots of unanswered questions for me as an atheist. Every worldview has unanswered questions. So I don't think this should be the thing that limits or as a deal killer for us as Christians. Now, I want to move over quickly to take a couple calls if I can before we go to the next hour with Alex Chediak, who wrote the book Preparing Your Teens for College. First, let me go to Andy in Atlanta. How are you, Andy? Good to talk to you. What's your question today? Go ahead.
First off, I just want to thank you so much for everything you've done. When I went to college, Cold Case Christianity was a huge help for me in answering a lot of the questions that I was encountering on campus.
Oh, that's awesome. Awesome to hear.
And one of my questions is, I was talking with an atheist the other day on campus,
mm-hmm.
and he was saying that, you know, sin is just a made-up idea, so forget about it anyway. And then in other conversations, he said, well, since God doesn't exist, then sin is like a moral crime against God, and so there's no such thing as sin. And he was asking me for evidence for sin, and I was like, well, I know that there's something wrong with that, but I'm not exactly sure how to respond. So with your former atheist background, how would you explain sin to other atheists in a way that would make sense to them?
Well, I think what you heard was actually a very accurate and sincere and honest reflection of a secular kind of an atheistic worldview. It's absolutely true that if there is no – forget about God for a second. If we don't think there's an objective, transcendent moral truth or set of moral truths, then it's true that no one has to – there is no objective wrong or right. We have to have something objective by which we measure, or all it really comes down to is a matter of cultural or personal opinion. And if you think something is wrong under that view of the world, but there is no objective sense of what right and wrong is, well, you can make something right by simply changing your mind, couldn't you? Because if it's all about your personal opinion, then it is true. And that's where I think the discussion needs to start. Are there some things that you think are transcendently wrong, regardless of who you are in the world, or what time in history you've lived, or what culture you emerge from? And of course, we always supersize this a little bit when we're talking to people. But you don't have to supersize it. I mean, you might say, is it ever okay to torture babies for fun? Has it ever been okay to torture babies for fun? Can you envision a scenario in which it could ever, in some way, for some reason, be okay, morally approvable, to torture babies for fun? Well, no. I mean, but this isn't the only kind of thing. Can you ever envision a scenario in which it's okay to kill people for the fun of it? Now, we may justify killings, and in California, I often have to deal with this. There are several exclusions to the murder law that are justifiable homicides, but none of them has ever been for the fun of it. That's never been a justification for killing somebody. So there are, I think most of us, if we think a little bit about this, we will sense that there are some things we say are transcendently wrong, regardless of time and history, place on the planet, or culture from which you emerge. And that's what we're really talking about. It's hard to use the word sin because for a lot of people, sin is attached to all the other things they may not like about Christianity or whatever worldview they came out of as a kid or whatever emotional baggage that is attached to that. That's a word that I typically will say, do you believe, instead of using the word sin? Are there some things that are transcendently wrong? For example, is it even going into your thought life, is it okay to think certain things for the fun of it? And I think that most of us would even go into, if you had to really personalize it, you bring in, you know this person you're talking to. There are certain values they typically hold. I had somebody, a friend of mine, for example, who didn't hold a lot of my conservative values, but she definitely held a number of values related to the environment. And I simply had to make those values, speak of those in transcendent terms, and she quickly acknowledged what she believed were certain transcendent truths related to the way the environment should be treated. Now, of course, if those are just opinion, I have every right to violate those as she does. And really, she really can't argue with me because it's all opinion anyway. It's like arguing with me about whether or not it's, chocolate chip cookies or brownies that is the best, dessert. Who cares? It's an opinion. But this is very different. So I think what I typically try to do, Andy, is I start with this idea. Are there objective things that they would even say, that your person you're talking to would even say, yeah, that is an objective. And if you know a little bit about that person, you can go to the things that they value and use those as examples. You're far more likely to get them to say, yes, that is an objective moral truth or an objective moral evil that I believe does transcend all of us. And you're never at liberty to do that kind of thing. And then the next question, of course, has to be, well, how do you ground that? How could you properly arrive at a transcendent truth principle unless there's a transcendent source for these? And that's what we really have to ask.
So what would be a good way to ask them, like, how they ground it? Because a lot of atheists are like, well, I can know what right and wrong is. I don't need a Bible or a book to tell me that. But then they never really get around to answering why. So what would be a good way to ask them, like, how they ground some of that stuff? Because a lot of times they just avoid the question.
And they may do that, Andy, but I think what you just asked a great question, though. If they're going to offer, if they're going to say to you, hey, I don't need the Bible in order to ground that, two differences. If they're saying, I don't need the Bible in order to behave a certain way or in order to believe certain things are true, I would affirm that because as a non-Christian for 35 years, I would have said the same thing. And if you'd have looked at my life from the outside looking at me, you probably would have thought in many ways I was a Christian because I did embrace certain values that I really couldn't justify given my worldview, but I accepted them as true and I accepted them as objectively true. But I hadn't thought much about how I could get to such a thing from the worldview that I held. So I think the question becomes when they say, well, I can accept certain things as objectively true without going in my Bible. That's the good follow-up time to say, okay, well, tell me then, how do I ground something as objectively true if there isn't an objective source? Forget about the Bible for a second. I'm talking about, is there a transcendent source? Now, we would call that God, but can you think of some other way? And then I would listen carefully to the kinds of other alternative approaches that are offered and begin to help them see how each of these is really insufficient. And even as I sit here with you, Andy, I don't even need to know the two or three ways they might offer because I already have confidence that there is no way to ground objective truths outside of an objective transcendent truth giver. And so this is something that's not – it's philosophically pretty sound. So no matter how they're going to do it, if they're going to say, well, it's through an evolutionary process. Well, so is the evolutionary process then of each individual? Is that what you're talking about? Or are you talking about the evolution of cultures and societies? Is that what you're talking about? And every time they offer one of these two alternatives, we can offer counterexamples. And one thing I want to talk about as we kind of get close to – we got a little bit of time here in this hour – is I want to just offer to you that that's a strategy that I know that Greg talks about in tactics, and we've talked about it before, and you find yourself using it anyway even if you don't think about it, is offering counterexamples. That's so valuable. So if someone says, I can ground this, and they give you a strategy X to ground objective moral truth, well, then I would ask, I'd provide an example of a counterexample and asked, well, then does this make sense in the counterexample? So, for example, if someone says to me, well, I think this is a matter of, you know, of grounding and evolutionary process, and the humans who seem to embrace these principles have a better chance of surviving. Therefore, they are still with us today. They have survived. And so you see this commonality of moral values embraced by humans who happen to have survived and have seen and actually experienced the survival benefit of such values. Well, okay, if that's the case, then this is a matter of the genetic evolution of each individual. So if I'm somebody who's committing horrific crimes, couldn't I argue that you cannot blame me for these crimes if my genetic history of evolution is different than yours? I mean, now you're blaming me for my biology? This is a matter of how could you ever do that? It wouldn't be fair. We would never convict somebody on the basis of biology. It'd be like convicting somebody on the basis of ethnicity. You just don't do that. So we know there has to be something more to this. If we said, well, it's a cultural thing, I think there are many counterexamples. I mean, this is exactly what was stated by World War II criminals in Nazi Germany. You can't try us in Nuremberg for something that our culture venerated and actually promoted us for this behavior. Just because your culture doesn't find it has value, you can't – if it's a matter of cultural – if the culture determines values, you're going to be hard-pressed to be able to offer that your culture's values are better than anyone else's. Every alternative that you might offer to ground objective moral truth seems to fail when it encounters the counterexample. But there is one view that makes sense of transcendent moral truths because they're grounded in something that doesn't change, that isn't dependent on history, that transcends history. And that, of course, is we believe that they are grounded in the nature of God. Not that God willy-nilly decides that these are the rules you must follow, but that, in fact, these rules are a reflection of God's holy nature. And that's, I think, the most sufficient way to ground such objective moral truths, if that makes sense, right? So we have 3 minutes. I'm going to, if you don't mind, Andy, I'm going to slip over to one more phone call, but I really appreciate you calling here at Stand to Reason. Thanks so much, and please call again. Okay.
Thanks, man.
No problem. Isaac, how are you? You have a question from Gardena, California. Thanks so much for calling. I know you've called before a few times, I think, haven't you? So I'm glad to hear from you again.
It's good to talk to you, too.
Really glad to hear from you. Now, your question today is about how do we know Christianity is true, but what do you mean when you ask it that way? I know that's what you told Melinda.
Well, I was reading some stuff by William Lane Craig about how do we know individually, personally, that Christianity is true. And I've learned that he makes a distinction that I think is probably useful, and he certainly believes it so, to distinguish between knowing that Christianity is true and showing that Christianity is true. And I was actually unaware of who was hosting, but I mean, it's really a question to anyone that I respect for being a Christian, certainly yourself. And so I'll direct it to you. And that is, how would you answer that question? How do you know personally, J. Warner Wallace, that Christianity is true?
Gosh, do you believe this? And here we have the music coming up for the end of the hour, Isaac. Okay, tell you what I'm going to do. We've got a guest coming up in the next hour, so I don't want to cut into his time. But what I will try to do is I will blog something and send it to Melinda so she can post it on the Stand to Reason blog this week, either tomorrow or the next day. So you'll have a blog in which I answer that question at str.org this week. And I apologize for not getting to your question earlier, okay, Isaac? But I will write something and post it this week. All right, folks, we're at the end of Hour 1. Thanks so much for joining us. In Hour 2, Alex Chediak on preparing your teens for college right here at Stand to Reason.
Here we are in Hour 2 of Stand to Reason Radio Show. I'm Jim Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel, who's usually here with you at this time. And we are, as we have been in the last hour, trying to look at life right side up, as we do it every week here at Stand to Reason. And one of the most important parts of all of this, looking at life right side up, is in preparing the next generation of young Christians who will be looking at life right side up. And this is something that has been a priority of Stand to Reason for many years. And you'll see this work featured on the homepage at STR.org and on the work of Brett and Alan and Greg as they go around the country and actually make the case for young people. But part of this has always been a desire on, for all of us as Christian case makers to target the group that seems to be at the most vulnerable at times, and that is young people who at some point are going to enter into the university experience and have to encounter in many ways for the first time the challenges of secular humanism, the challenges of a world, of a culture that is less and less Christian as each year passes. Now, if you're not familiar with Alex Chediak, he's been on our show before, and I've had the luxury of the privilege, actually, of interviewing him. He's an author, speaker, a professor of engineering and physics at Cal Baptist University right down the road here. So Alex has got a lot of experience in the university setting, and so I think he's in a unique position to talk about this. So, Alex, thanks so much for joining us here at Stand to Reason. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Jim. Appreciate it.
Well, I want to just talk a little bit about you were here once before when talking about Thriving at College, which is your first book, which I think did fabulously. And we actually have Preparing Your Teens for College, your follow-up, at the STR bookstore. So you can get on str.org, go to the bookstore. You'll see it offered there. So it's a great place to pick it up. And you've written a book now, and I think you said it so well in your preface, your introduction to the book, how at some point, you know, you get asked questions. And you think, well, I think I've written about that, but maybe I haven't written about that. And you were asked a question, weren't you, kind of about the first book that you realized the answer wasn't in the first book, and so you needed to write a second.
Right. I was on a radio show, and someone said, well, how can parents get their teens ready? I'm thinking, well, the book I wrote was for college students, but I really need to – that question got me thinking, how can I help parents get their kids ready? Because the world's changing with regard to college. As you know, college is becoming more expensive, way faster than the rate of inflation, and it's taking up a bigger portion of parents' income and savings, and parents are concerned about that, and for good reason. But secondly, college is becoming more significant professionally and financially. The so-called earnings premium, the additional money that a college graduate earns relative to a non-college graduate, that's been rising. You know, in 1979, a high school graduate was paid 77 cents on the dollar for what a college graduate made. Today, that figure is down to 62 cents.
Wow.
So that's why parents, if you ask them, they say college is too expensive, but it's very important. So they want to keep sending their kids there, but they realize it's too expensive. They're scared because of the price. But the third factor is that even though we send lots of kids to college, we actually have the highest dropout rate in the industrialized world. Only 56% of those who begin at a four-year college actually graduate in 6 years. And at two-year schools, it's even worse. Only 29% of those who begin at a community college or any two-year school graduate in 3 years. So at a time when college has never been more expensive or more professionally significant, too many of our students are not making it. And that's what really burdened me to say, how can I help, as a professor who deals with students, and I deal with a lot of freshmen too, mostly freshmen, how can I help parents prepare students that when they come, they're ready to succeed?
Now, and interestingly, the book is not just it's purely about, you know, how to succeed academically at school. It's really divided nicely into broader categories that I think would be important to any of us as Christian parents, because a lot of us as Christian parents, you know, yeah, we want a certain level of financial success for our kids, but we also know that sometimes financial success can be a defeater of character success. And so you've kind of broken the book up into several segments dealing with character, faith, relationships, finances, academics. Now, most of us, sadly, you know, we're here in Southern California, and in Orange County or Los Angeles County, you see there's such a great emphasis, maybe because it's so expensive to live and it's so hard to make it here, right, and the cost of living is so high. You just see this if you were to ask parents, hey, what's the one way that you want your kids to be successful in college? I suspect it's going to end up being academic first. And issues of character, faith, relationships, those kinds of things are probably going to be lower because we're so concerned about the financial ability of our students. So, but you haven't written it in that order. You've actually written it, that's why I thought it was interesting, in the exact reverse order.
looking at issues of character, faith, and relationship first, and issues about academic success last. Why did you write it in that order?
Right. I did that because I believe that character and maturity are the foundation for success in college and beyond. It's really a roadmap. The book is about preparing your teens for college and adulthood, mm-hmm. because preparing them for college is a subset of preparing them for adulthood. The values that you inculcate in their life growing sure. up are going to be reflected in their choices in college and beyond. And really, character and maturity are what determine whether freshmen and sophomore make it to be juniors and seniors. And what is the best foundation for character and maturity? It's the personal relationship with our Lord Christ, being truly converted, knowing what you believe and why you believe it, wanting to live in the light of it, and honor God in the classroom, in the workplace. That's what gives you the foundation for succeeding in college.
Makes sense. Now let's just – I want to just – before we start, I think I asked you this last time we were together, but I just want to ask you again, because this week Ed Stetzer wrote a blog in which he kind of – he would call it himself, I think, or people who have written about it have kind of called it a rant against the idea that really – that young people are, in fact, leaving Christianity or leaving the church, let's say, in the kinds of numbers that they have typically been reported in, say, in the last 10 years. Now, I've collected some of this data, mm-hmm. and so I know that – and you've mentioned it just briefly in one of the chapters as well. And so the question really becomes, do we think that it's as bad as sometimes it's painted, or is it more complex than that? And what, you know, what is the real challenge that you think is waiting for young Christians? And so that might be – I'm wondering if that's what kind of guided you in wanting to write the book, or at least in the way you wrote the book, given that challenge.
Yeah, definitely in the way I wrote the book. I mean, having two chapters on faith formation was because it's so crucial. I think the numbers are sometimes overblown. When teens come from households where their mom and dad are living out their faith throughout the week, are talking about it in their home, are showing their teens by their life, by their word, and by their deed, how they're living because of what they believe, those teens actually more often than not do persevere in the faith. So I think the numbers sometimes are exaggerated. There is often a process where the teen is wrestling with the faith for themselves, and they may go through a period of months or maybe up to a year where they're wrestling with it intellectually, maybe morally, the commands of God, why does God command these things? But that is actually a healthy process whereby the teen is owning the faith for themselves, because they mm-hmm. can't just coast in their parents' faith in a secular university. They have to actually believe it for themselves and see right. it as reasonable.
Right. That makes sense. Now, so when you put this together, I mean, I think part of it, sometimes people will say, well, you know, you weren't just following up on Thriving at College. This is almost a prequel.
It's almost a prequel. It's exactly
to Thriving
a prequel.
At College.
Yeah,
but what's great about it is the way you kind of broken the sections down. And let's just start, though, with the first concern that I know that even most parents I encounter who are making choices. You did a good job at the end of the book, toward the end of the book, of talking about a selection, the selection process of what kind of college you would, but mm-hmm. but you know, a lot of what you're talking about in the book, Alex, is not stuff that, you know, you can start thinking about college selection a year before you start, you know, sending out your applications and stuff.
Right.
But a lot of the stuff you're talking about in the book is not something you can start a year before you go to college.
No. I designed the book so that a parent who has a kid who's 12, 13 years old would hopefully pick it up and start working on it. Well, something changes when a kid turns 12 or 13, right? Mm-hmm. The kid begins to mature. The kid begins to think like a young adult. They begin to question. They begin to say, well, I'm not just going to do what you said because you said it. I want to know why you said it. I want to know why I should do it. I want to know if I should believe that, if I should live that way. So mm-hmm. a teen is starting to, and I remember that in my own life very clearly, starting to wrestle with, is Christianity true? Why should I live this way? Why should I save sex for marriage? Why should I not drink alcohol? Why does God command these things? And they begin to reason and think in a different and mature mm-hmm. way. I think a parent has to engage them differently then. One of the mistakes I think we often make is treating our children like children when they are actually young adults, and we don't develop them to take on the responsibility for themselves. We kind of shelter them a little bit by treating them like children, even though they're 15, 16 years old. We need to start grooming them for adulthood.
Is that one of the areas that you think parents have really dropped the ball most significantly? Or is there some area in particular that you think that really, you know, if you get one thing as a parent from reading this book, the one area that I think parents are stumbling the most, this is the thing you need to get. What would you call that? What would you identify that as?
Well, I think it's preparing the teen to act and think like an adult, to take responsibility for their own life. I see in the college sector and in the college environment, I see teens who get there and who still depend on their parents for things that we did on our own. Mm-hmm. I've seen students tell me that I can't check my homework. No one ever taught me how to check it. My mom checked it for me. Or I'll see students who don't know how to study for a test or take notes in a class. So academic skills that haven't been developed. I'll see kids who don't know how to manage their time. who just think, well, I'm in class for 15 hours a week. That means I can play for 50 hours a week, right?
Right, right.
And they haven't learned that college is going to be a lot of work, and it's going to be work that we require you to do on your own and discipline yourself to manage your time, to control your impulses. So whatever parents can do to help their teens learn to act and think like young adults in mm-hmm. their teen years, that's going to go a long way.
Yeah, and that's something that it's very hard to put your hands around a specific strategy to help that occur. But, you know, you notice it in small ways. If I've had, you know, I got four kids, mm-hmm. and some of these kids have been very self-motivated about getting up, and some have not been so self-motivated. But if you're somebody who has to have your parent wake you up every day, at some point you're not going to have dad and mom around to do that for you. Even something as simple as that. I think it is a matter of releasing the daily responsibilities and letting the consequence for failure
right.
occur.
Yeah, I think natural consequences are a great teacher, especially as they're in the teen years. You want to give them more liberty, more freedom. Oftentimes, as parents, we're freaked out and think, well, what if he blows it? What if he doesn't do it right? What if he gets a C on the test instead of a B on the test? Well, that will be what God uses to teach him what he needs to learn. So let them suffer some minor negative consequences while they're growing up, the natural consequences of their own mistakes, because those will train them to avoid bigger mistakes when they leave the home.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, that's something that it's hard, though. I mean, that's I think, a hard thing to train parents to do. Now, let's just shift gears for a minute, because I went back to this whole idea of what is the thing that I typically hear from my friends. You know, when my kids now are adults, or I have some upper high school, junior and a senior, and my other kids are adults. And so I've got two who have been through the process and two that are about to enter into the process. And what I see repeatedly is kind of a concern amongst parents of my age on how in the world are we going to be able to afford this? You know, how in the world also did this ever get – you know, I was looking at what my master's degree, 108-unit master's degree at UCLA. Mm-hmm. I think I spent 40 – this is 1985 to 88. Mm-hmm. I spent $4,500 total for a 108-unit master's degree at UCLA.
It's a good deal.
Yeah, so now as an undergraduate, I mean, it's like it's $100,000 to send my son or to get an undergraduate degree at UCLA. So, and that's, you know, mine was 3 years full time, and his is four. Yeah. So I'm just trying to figure out how did this jump from $4,500 to $100,000, and what do you make of the kind of impact? Especially, look, Alex, let's face it, a lot of us as Christians, especially if we're in ministry, mm-hmm. or we've really decided that we're going to live a life in which we're going to donate a significant amount of our financial resources to the work of God, mm-hmm. I think that the Christians that I know, we're typically driving the more beat-up cars, and we're typically stretching ourselves. We're trying to do the work of ministry in addition to our practical. How are we going to be able to afford this?
Right. Right. Well, I think it's a matter of three things. First of all, not everyone needs to go to a four-year college. I think we've kind of oversold that somewhat. The percentage of people going to four-year college is 66% versus half of that. So two in three going to four-year college, one in three going to two-year college. But the job market's actually more like 60-40 or 55-45. So what happens is sometimes people overgo to four-year colleges because they think I have to go or I'm not going to have a job or whatnot. But actually, associate degrees are very strategic nowadays, especially in the healthcare or technology. Mm-hmm. These are very strategic degrees. If you graduate high school in the bottom 40% of your class, your chance of graduating college in 8 years is about 25%.
Wow.
Yet those people continue to go to four-year colleges because they believe that's the only option for them. So we have to elevate across the board, all solutions being good, two-year colleges, trade schools, apprenticeships, the military. There's more than one path to professional success after high school. We have to have that mentality. Secondly, don't overpay for school. Some people chase prestige, and mm-hmm. they borrow gobs of money so they can brag about whether their kid's going to college.
Right.
And that's a big mistake. What's more important than where you go to college is that you go to college and graduate. Mm. 10 years from now, no one's asking you where you got your diploma from. They just know that you got a master's degree, you got a bachelor's degree. That's what matters. Make a budget and stick to it. And assess the net price, not the sticker price, because there are websites that I talk about in my book where you can analyze different colleges to see how generous they are in financial aid, not just offering you a bunch of loans, but offering you scholarships and grants that lower your actual price.
Yes, makes sense.
The third thing I point out is borrow relative to future earnings. There's a difference between an engineer borrowing $20,000 and an elementary education teacher borrowing $20,000 in terms of how easily, the relative ease and with which they're going to be able to pay that money back. how much of a burden is $20,000 going to be on an elementary ed teacher versus an engineer?
Absolutely.
So that's the difference.
Yeah, and that's something that you – I mean, you got a chance to see this working in this setting, Alex. So let me ask you that. I always worry – give you an example of this. My son is in med school at a major university here in Southern California. It's incredibly expensive. His loans for the next 4 years will be over $300,000.
Wow.
That's what it's going to cost. Now, we could help him with his undergraduate, but these are loans he's – now, his gamble here,
it's a gamble.
Say it this way, it's a gamble, is that he's going to be in a position as a doctor to at least be able to pay these back.
Right.
And at some point within the first 10 years of working as a doctor, he'll be able to pay these loans back.
Right.
Now, in order to do that, though, there are definitely certain forms of medicine practice that he's going to have to take on. Mm-hmm. Either, say, anesthesiology or neurology or dermatology. These things pay quite well.
Right.
So what we're seeing, I think, at that level is a decrease in the number of primary care physicians coming out of these programs. Are you seeing something similar?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
For example, if it's going to cost me the same amount to get a degree in to become a math teacher or to become an electrical engineer, wouldn't it be wiser to be the electrical engineer, even if I've got a proficiency in math?
Right, right. Exactly. What's happening is engineering is growing. Majors are growing that have a perceived high demand in the job market. That is happening. And what happens sometimes is students who aren't really prepared for those majors are going after them anyway because they want the money. Mm-hmm. And so I deal with that in my book, Preparing Your Teens for College, because I don't think making money alone is a good motivation
yes.
for work. We ought to be motivated by what are the skills God's given us? What are the interests God's given us? How do those overlap? How can we best be useful in the world to God's glory? And then the money will be a byproduct. The money will come. When we're useful for other people, money will be there.
That's right.
And so, but what we are seeing, even in the English department and history department, we are seeing professors now market their programs along the lines of, these are the top five jobs. This is the amount of income you can make when you graduate, because students are more attuned to the financial piece.
Yeah, and there's a danger, I think, and the culture kind of drives this danger, that we perceive value
right.
based on the kind of monetary compensation we get for what we do. And
exactly.
and as a law enforcement, working as a cop, I used to always say, if we hire kids because they think we're going to pay them more or give them better time off or give them great benefits, we're hiring them from the wrong reason. This is a job that needs to be about sacrifice,
right.
selflessness, and a view of your service outweighing whatever the compensation may be.
And those who go into that job with that mentality will probably end up being better cops.
Absolutely. And they'll be happier
they'll
while
be happier.
They're cops.
Exactly
yeah. So,
right.
so you're absolutely right. Now, after the break, I want to take a short break here. When we come back, I want to talk about a kind of a common thing that I see all that. You call them helicopter parents or tiger moms. This idea that, hey, we want to help our kids grow up. We have these high expectations for them. But how do we prevent ourselves as parents from kind of being the annoying, hovering, actually disabled of our kids' future
right.
by treating it in this way. So we'll take a quick break and come back right here on Stand to Reason.
You can take STR with you through our apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad, available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen live to STR's weekly webcast, to podcast archives by all of our STR speakers, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and much, much more. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. It's free, so download the app today through iTunes or the Android market, and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Don't forget, Stand to Reason's live broadcast is Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. on the web. That's Pacific time, by the way. So go to str.org to listen live or use your STR app to stream it live. You can also give me a piece of your mind by calling at that time, Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. Here's the number, 855-243-9975. And, of course, you can listen on the radio, like always, on Sundays, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific time. But for the live broadcast, tune in online Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time by going to str.org.
back here at Stand to Reason. This is Jim Wallace sitting in for Greg Kolkel, speaking with Alex Chediak, who's written the book Preparing Your Teens for College, Faith, Friends, Finances, and Much More. And Alex, of course, wrote a book prior to this that was wildly successful called Thriving at College, which is on my shelf at home as well. And if you're like me and you've got young kids who are either right before college age or are in college now, I mean, look, all of us, I think, are concerned about, did we do a good enough job? Are we doing a good enough job? And we all have high expectations for what we want our kids to do. And maybe as Christians, our expectations are even higher. So, Alex, as we think about this, even though we have these high expectations, you know, how do we avoid being the nuisance? And, gosh, if you've coached a team, let's say, you've seen these kinds of parents with the kids on your team. If you've volunteered in a school, you've seen these, and then at some point you ask yourself, am I one of those parents too? So tell us, how do we avoid being what you'd label as a helicopter parent?
Yeah, I think it's an issue of letting go gradually in as they get older, 12, 13, 14. Now you start to treat them like adults in the years of being apprentices towards adulthood. The whole mentality of an apprentice in the old days was 6-7 years, right? Where you were training somebody to take over on their own. Seeing high school years, the teen years, as being apprenticing years for adulthood. That means giving them more freedom, knowing that they might make mistakes here and there, but they're still in our home. We can help them assess their mistakes, and the mistakes are going to have minor consequences when they're 13. They're going to have major consequences when they're 20.
Yeah.
You know, I had a friend of mine in college who got into credit card debt by about $5,000. Not a huge amount, but his parents found out about it, and his dad just wrote him a check for $5,000 and handed it to him. And the kid thought, score, right?
Yeah.
Dad just took care of it. 10 years later, that same young man got in debt by $50,000 because he never learned from his mistakes. So I think there's an issue of it hurts us to see our kids fall and fail. But if we let them reap the consequences, if we let the pain do its work, then they'll actually be stronger and more likely to succeed when the consequences are higher.
Isn't that always the case, though, too? That is a classic problem that we have as parents. Is that we constantly, and I do it, we all do it, we want to remove pain. We hate to see our kids in any kind of pain.
Right.
But there are times, I think you're right, when, and we see this in law enforcement all the time too, that the kids who are repeat offenders and then ultimately end up being career criminals are those kids who did not experience really the severity of punishment and the quickness of punishment. It has to be both severe, and that's different for every kid.
Right.
And it has to be quick, immediate.
Right.
And if it's not immediate, if you take that and delay that pain,
they won't see cause and effect.
Yes, you won't see a cause and effect. And you see, by the time they actually does snowball, it's almost far too late to have the kind of consequence we want it to have. But okay, so that's a strategy. And I've seen two ways to do this, two ways to kind of look at this practically when the rubber meets the road. Okay, let's say I've got a teenager. He's in high school. She's in high school. And she's got great grades. And, I mean, she can pour it on. You see great potential, straight A's. But a lot of that's because you've protected this child's schedule. You've never required them to have to hold down a part-time job. And, you know, as a result – great grades, but never really kind of, you know, developed. And maybe you've even encouraged other activities that would have limited her ability to work. So, for example, she's serving in student body government, or she's all good things, you know, serving at her church group, attending youth group, and studying like crazy and got a tutor maybe. And so all these things kind of add up on your clock.
Yeah.
Now I've got a kid who I've really protected in a way to allow them to succeed academically. But I haven't really provided them any opportunities. Now, there's a responsibility in that, I get. But you haven't really provided them the kind of work experience to learn about. So I'm always kind of struggling myself, which is the better approach?
Yeah, I think if a kid works too much in high school and it hurts their grades, that's a bad investment. Because the amount of money they can make in high school is really low relative to getting higher grades, getting higher SAT scores can actually save them a lot of money at college because they're going to get a scholarship or a grant that they wouldn't otherwise get. At the same time, you want to have the teen learn how to balance multiple responsibilities. One of the dangers I see in college right now is when students, when their parents are paying for everything, the kid does not appreciate it and they don't use their time well. The students that maximize their study time at college are the ones who are also working part-time jobs. They actually have higher grades than the kids who don't have part-time jobs.
That's the dilemma I always find. So how do you balance that? I'm seeing the same thing you are. And so those all my kids, I've encouraged them to pick up the part-time job. And usually I said, okay, this amount of the expense is going to be yours. So if you want to drive,
gas and insurance is yours.
Yep.
You might get an old kickdown clunker from the from your mom and dad that you don't really kind of like, but that'll be sufficient for you. So, but if you want to insure it so you can drive it and gas it up, that's going to have to be yours. And if you get in an accident, by the way, that's going to be your expense. Okay. So I've tried to kind of – but again, that can then weigh in on whether or not you can perform well in school. It's, I guess it's kind of a balancing act for each of us as parents.
Yeah, I think so. And each kid is different. I mean, the rule of thumb that I kind of think is valid for the majority of students is a 10 to 15-hour a week part-time job will not hurt them in school. It'll actually help them in school. Because when they look at their schedule that freshman year and they say, okay, I'm in class 15 hours a week, they are helped by seeing 10 to 15 more hours blocked off for a job. Because what it makes them do is it makes them appreciate their free time, enjoy right. their friendships, definitely have a good time with their friends, but also schedule study times and be more disciplined because someone else is helping them be disciplined. Too much free time for a freshman can be debilitating. It could actually lead to terrible performance because they just fritter away their time thinking, I'm going to have enough time for that test. Then they goof around till the test is coming and they're studying up the last night all night long
yeah.
and they're half asleep in class. I've seen that happen repeatedly. That never happens, though, with the kid who has that 15-hour-a-week job.
Well, do you see this as – am I correct in understanding this? I kind of anticipate this is the case, but I could be wrong. Would you say that folks, like for example, at community colleges, mm-hmm. students are going to are probably more likely to live at home?
Yes, that's right. They're more likely to to work a part-time job, and they're less likely to graduate. One of the sad things that happens is they don't have enough mentoring and enough future orientation to see where that academics could lead. I've known good students who graduated high school, and because their parents never went to college, they went to community college. They could have gotten into great school if they went to community college, and they never got mentoring, advising, so they stayed there for 3-4 years, collected a bunch of credits, and then they transferred to a 4-year school, and they had to spend another 3 years over there, spending
right.
more money, more
right,
time.
Right.
All because of a lack of mentoring and structure.
Yeah, there is a sense at the community college, isn't there,
that
you could, yeah, you can kind of not just get lost in the crowd, but you can get lost in the path that's supposed to directly take you someplace. And maybe it's because it's so cheap that
yeah.
no one's trying to maximize, hey, dude, you need to get out of here in 4 years. This is costing us an arm and a leg.
Right.
You could go there for 3 years and it's not going to cost all that much. So what's the urgency?
Especially if you're living at home.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I think, yeah, you need to have at least a high school teacher that sits down with you and says, you know what, you have potential to be an engineer, a lawyer, a history teacher, a math teacher, whatever, and say go to community college and save money, but be there for no more than 2 years. And start right now talking to that 4-year college about how your classes are going to transfer because you don't want to waste time taking classes that are not going to transfer.
Right, absolutely.
You got to repeat them. So having a 4-year vision, having a vision for graduating
yes.
college, assessing the finances of the whole thing, that is so crucial to saving money.
Yeah, my first son, he treated community college as though he was already at UCLA.
Right.
He was just there for the first two. He did exactly what he was supposed to do. And the beginning of the third year, he was transferred into UCLA. At the end of the fourth, he was graduated with his bachelor's. So he treated it like, you know, I'm already at UCLA, but I'm here right now. He wasn't really even knowing he could get into UCLA, but he treated it like the first 2 years of a 4-year experience rather than, I'm not sure what I want to do. I'll just kind of figure it out while I'm here.
And that's so crucial for teens, I think, is to have that future orientation of where their actions today are affecting their life tomorrow.
Yeah.
The kids who think instant gratification and they can't look 3 months down the road, 6 months down the road, they're the ones who had the biggest struggles in college. The kids who understand that my work now affects my success later, those are the ones who succeed. I always tell my students the first day of class, my job is to prepare you for success 4 years from now. Whether you like me now is secondary to my considerations.
Right,
that's the
right.
secondary importance. What I want,
right.
what my main goal is to make you successful because ultimately you're going to be happier when you are successful. If I just try to make you happy now and make the class easier and bending the rules and bending
right,
the grades,
right.
you might be happy now, but 4 years from now you're going to be like, man, I'm not prepared for life.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, we've spent about half of our time so far just talking about some of the mechanics and some of the important – and then we could be having this discussion if we were non-Christians talking about
right.
what's going to help our students be successful. But I want to turn a corner now
yeah.
and talk about the things that are specific to those of us who are Christians, who are concerned about – and look, I think sometimes when you are looking at ministries like ours that are trying to prepare young people – you can get focused and think, well, it's worse than it's going to be. Maybe there's really something terrible waiting for them at college. And that's not what we're trying to portray here. But I do think that movies like, for example, God's Not Dead
right.
just came out. And for a lot of people who saw that movie, that was maybe the first time they ever thought about what their kids might experience in a secular environment.
Right.
So let's just talk for a minute about the kinds of discussions that you think you might see and we might should be preparing our kids for at secular universities. Maybe even they're starting to have these questions or have these conversations now in public school and high school. I mean, that's not unusual, right? So, and typically they're not like the conversation you would see at God's Not Dead. Typically they're one-sided.
Yes.
They are a professor dictating the course of this class, dictating the conversation, dictating the direction it takes. So what do you tell parents? I mean, what is kind of the advice you're offering in preparing your teens for college? This book that's just being published by Tyndale. What's the kind of advice you're offering?
I remember my wife's first week at Stanford University. Mm-hmm. She was a biology major, and her teacher began the class saying, "Some of you came from homes that believed the Bible, and you went to church on Sunday, and that's great. But I want you to know that has no bearing on what happens in this class." So immediately compartmentalizing the faith, and that's very common in secular universities.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, you're a Christian, or you're a Buddhist, or you're Jewish, or you're Hindu, or whatever. That's fine. That's for Sunday morning or your worship time over there. That has no bearing on your intellectual development. So helping – I think teens need to know that there are credible reasons. That Christianity is a reasonable faith. I mean, you look at – of all the faiths in the world, I mean, we're one that is based on historic events that actually occurred that were verifiable to those that lived that day. I mean, take Mormonism or Islam, based on some vision that someone supposedly had that can't be verified by anybody. Christianity is based on the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who was witnessed by 500 people at one time.
Right, right.
And so helping them understand that we have a credible, intellectually reasonable faith is faith based on reason, not faith versus reason.
Yeah.
I think the world – I remember at Berkeley, I was a graduate student there. People try to make everything about faith compartmentalized from your life. And we're seeing that in society as well.
Sure.
You have a faith, and that faith is private, and it can't possibly have any mm-hmm. bearing for what you actually do in the real world.
Right, right, right. So does this mean then that our kids have to kind of go out there with this sword, you know, and wield it in this – this happened to my son in undergraduate work at UC Santa Barbara. Uh-huh. You know, there's a sense that teach those courses in genetics or in, you know, the hard sciences especially,
right.
that really if you're going to come in here and you believe those things, that's fine, but it has to stop at the door.
Right.
There's no room for that here, and here we just deal with truth.
Mm-hmm.
We deal with science here, and those kinds of personal – fictions are great for you, but not in this room. And I think that's so intimidating.
Yes.
And not that it's going to happen. It doesn't happen all that often, if I'm honest about it. It wasn't all that often, but he had it in a few classes.
Yep.
But there is a sense that this is not welcome. And so what's the best approach you've seen so far? Is it better for us to kind of quietly navigate our grades and, you know, are the papers we write? There's a lot of classes where it's not a, you know, multiple choice test. These are papers that have to be evaluated subjectively by a professor who has a view of Christianity that's
right.
hostile to yours.
I remember having a philosophy professor at Alfred University. I went to my undergrad at Alfred University in New York, and he was an atheist, and he taught freshman philosophy. And my first test, it was essay exam. I got a B- on it, which I had gotten A's in high school. So I'm like, okay, what's wrong with this? So I went to him, and after I got over kind of the irritation of getting a B-, I was like, okay, it's helped me to be a better writer. And he helped me, and I realized that it was good to get some help from somebody who's smart and who can write well and doesn't agree with me, but I can still learn things from them. Instead of, I think what some Christians sometimes do is they say, well, you gave me a bad grade because I'm a Christian or because I wrote in my paper that I believe in God. And that may have happened, but that may not have happened.
Right.
So a humble disposition that says, I want to learn from you because you have an education that I don't have, that's a winsome tactic for that adorns the gospel, that makes the gospel look beautiful. Then when that professor finds out you're a Christian, your lifestyle is matching what you believe.
Mm.
And realizing that you don't have to necessarily convert him. What you want to do is represent Christianity well.
Mm.
Articulate what you believe, but articulate it in your lifestyle as well. And what you do in your papers is one thing. In the classroom, I don't think you have to argue every
right.
time because you don't have – it's not an even playing field. The professor has the microphone. They have the control of the conversation. I've seen some be very open to good conversations with Christians in classroom, and those are the ones that I would encourage students to go ahead and engage. If the professor is really open-minded and really wants to let you make your case, make your case. If the professor wants to just rant, then just maybe poke a Columbo-type question at him. Poke
right,
a question
right.
that exposes the weakness
right.
Of their argument instead of pontificating back to them.
Yeah, I'm just going to do a shameless plug real quick because I saw that we just posted on standardreasonstr.org that there's a some resources that are available for dads and grads, and that's one of those is Greg's book, Tactics. So on the homepage, if you shoot over there. Also, of course, is you know Alex's books are also incredibly important, but what you're saying here is that sometimes a tactical approach in these settings are critical, yeah. and you've got to actually take a tactical approach. And this is one of the things I think was a huge advantage of Greg's work in the book, Tactics, is over on the homepage. You can see it there for dads and grads. Now, let's just talk for a second about, because we have come up on a break here in a few minutes. You know, we're talking about really practical terms of how you can you've kind of mentioned in the book, and it's not a slow process, okay? I mean, not a quick process, rather. It's going to take time. Mm-hmm. How do we as parents, though, kind of give our kids the confidence to be able to even address these issues in front of a professor? In other words, I think a part of it for me was modeling how these conversations might look. So my mm-hmm. students growing up in my house mm-hmm. saw me in conversation with my friends, you know, around mm-hmm. the dinner table. But a lot of this is just personality driven. I've got a couple of my kids would probably just be more comfortable not saying anything. Mm-hmm. But I think in the end, as Christian parents, we sometimes might make them feel bad that they're not willing mm-hmm. to make a defense. Mm-hmm. Now, you're right now in a Christian university at mm-hmm. Cal Baptist. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that there's a difference? You kind of did you also teach in a secular setting?
I was a teaching assistant in secular settings. I never was a full professor, but I TA'd undergrads, and so I was around them a lot.
Okay, before we go to break, just help our parents to see what is the difference and what kinds of advice. Sometimes as parents we think, oh, I'm going to protect my students by sending them to a Christian university.
I think even if they go to a Christian university, they have to be prepared to understand why do God's commandments seem to limit what I can do for fun? That's a big one. So they need to understand that God's moral laws are meant to maximize our pleasure, not rob us from pleasure. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, once they get out of the home, they will find other people who also want to go off the deep end. They'll yeah. find each other in the campus, and you'll have problems. They won't be as frequent as you have in a UCLA kind of a school, but they will occur. So helping them understand that God's laws are meant to protect you from harm and to maximize your pleasure. And then intellectually, helping them understand that Christianity is credible, teaching them some basic apologetics for junior and senior year of high school, I think is crucial in this day and age. And to talk about the cultural issues that are happening and help them relate their faith to them. Like, for example, why has society shifted the definition of marriage so quickly? What are the underpinnings that made that possible? And talking about that in the home, helping them to become more comfortable. But you're right, in the personality, every kid's going to be different. Some kids are more extroverted, some kids are more introverted. Help them to, within their personality, be faithful to Christ. Maybe one-on-one with friends is going to be a natural setting for them.
Well, let me just rabbit trail for a second then. Do you see what I'm seeing too, that this issue, for example, of same-sex marriage and homosexuality is becoming the wedge issue on universities related to whether or not Christianity continues to have a voice in culture?
Oh yeah. Oh absolutely. I mean, if you don't believe in the same-sex marriage, you are now a bigot, you're narrow-minded, you're arrogant. So this whole idea of tolerance has been robbed by the world. The word tolerance used to mean you and I disagree on a few things, but I'm still going to respect you. I'm going to be kind to you. Now tolerance means you adhere to the politically correct line or you are out. That's
right.
Tolerance has become an intolerance because it's become intolerant of anything that doesn't agree with the so-called accepted view,
sure. Yeah, that, it has changed completely.
And so, conviction is seen as arrogance. If you believe in Jesus Christ being the only way to God, that conviction is itself a mark of arrogance in the world now.
Right. So how are you helping – what are you telling parents who see the same thing I see?
Yeah.
I mean, what's our strategy here? In some ways, it can seem rather discouraging. You're thinking, what in the world then do I do with my young people to get them ready to face this challenge in university?
I think you help them see that that compassion and conviction can go hand in hand. We can be people of conviction and people of people of compassion. We can love people who we disagree with. We can believe the gospel, believe that Christ is the only way to God, believe the Bible is the word of God, believe that with all our heart, and still be gracious and loving towards those we disagree with. And to help them to show their non-Christian friends, you know what? Just because I believe certain things doesn't mean I'm an intolerant person. I'm not a bigot. I'm not narrow-minded. I'm actually submitting myself to what I believe God's revealed as truth. And in my view, you are actually the one who's being arrogant, saying I'm the arbiter of truth. But I'm still going to love you, even though I think you're the one taking the wrong position. So helping them to model with their friends a winsome disposition that says, I disagree with you, but I'm still going to treat you with respect and kindness.
Yeah, I think sometimes the challenge, too, is that takes work and it takes time to develop those relationships. It's easy to throw out the rhetorical one-line objection. It's so much harder to build the relationship that responds to the one-line objection. Mm-hmm. You can't just throw out a one-line objection and back and achieve anything. Right. Anyway, we'll take a break right now here at Standard. We come back with Alex Chediak, who's written a book called Preparing Your Teens for College, Faith, Friends, Finances, and Much More. We'll do that right after the break here at Stand to Reason.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians, just like you, will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to iDonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org. Or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
Jim Wallace back here at Stand to Reason, sitting in for Greg Kokel, speaking with Alex Chediak, the author of Preparing Your Teens for College, Faith, Friends, Finances, and Much More. If you are catching us late in the show, please be sure to get back to str.org and podcast. I think most of us now are familiar with how to podcast, and so it's a good place to do that. You can catch the entire interview with Alex. We're talking about a lot of important things that relate to our young teenagers and how they're going to get ready to spend the next 4 years away from us. And one of the things that they're going to do over the next 4 years as they're away from us, Alex, is they're going to have the freedom. And Brett and I talk about this mathematical equation that can be an equation for disaster if we're not careful. And it's that, number one, we don't prepare our kids well enough. Two, we put them in a situation where sometimes professors are somewhat hostile to their – or the campus community, the campus culture is hostile to their worldview. And then the third thing I always see, and we were talking about this earlier, is that all of our students, when away from us, are now in a place where they're able to chase their fallen desire, sometimes with liberty, for the very first time. Mm-hmm. And those three things combined really lead to disaster sometimes. Let's talk a little bit about how to prepare our kids, because I think the first place that our students sometimes encounter objectionable ideas, objectionable images, objectionable worldviews, mm-hmm. is online while they're in our home. Mm-hmm. And so they've already been saturated from an online experience before they're now at complete liberty to explore that experience. So what do we do to kind of prepare our students given the hazards of the online reality?
Yeah, I think we start them off with internet in public places. I mean, I see no reason to put a 14-year-old boy with internet in his own room at night. You might as well tell him, hey, there's a stack of pornographic magazines in the closet. Please don't go in there.
Yeah.
He's going to eventually go in there. So protecting them in the sense of limiting their exposure to sin when they're just developing sexually, that's not the time you want them to be learning how to control that freedom of the internet. So give them the internet in a public place, start them off that way, and then move them towards greater freedom, but provide it for them accountability. There's internet filters out there like Be Secure Online, Covenant Eyes, Safe Eyes. These products let you control what content comes to any of your family members on any device, whether it be a phone, a tablet, or a laptop, or a desktop. And then accountability. So there's accountability of what you see on the internet and of who you talk to. Because part of the problem is you can create a username for yourself and then approach girls or guys in college and do all kind, or in high school rather, and send all kinds of crazy things because you're anonymous. No one knows who you are.
Right, right. They think you're anonymous.
They think you're anonymous, mm-hmm. Right. And so helping teens understand the importance that independence doesn't mean unaccountable. And when you become an adult, accountability is very good for us because as sinners, even though we're saved by grace through faith, we're still struggles with sin all our life. And so having accountability is helpful. My wife knows all my passwords, knows what happens on my phone. I don't have any private identity that goes unseen, and that's good for me. And so I want my kids to know that this is why Dad has accountability, because it's good for him. And by the way, you're going to be accountable. We're going to monitor your cell phone, your internet usage for the same reasons. And we're going to prepare you for the day in which you have these in which you are somewhere where you have more freedom. Hopefully you'll have had 5 or 6 years of developing the right habits in our home.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And it's interesting, isn't it, that some of these products that we talk about, like Covenant Eyes, there's also one called Pandora's Hope. It's actually a router. So the router itself is the filter. So no matter what device comes into the house, whether they've got the application installed or not, it has to go through that router. And that router then sends a list of everything that was surfed that day to any number of accountability partners in the house, be it mom, dad, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you can tell that, you know, on Johnny's phone, this is what was being watched today. And what's interesting about that is that once we know that our private life online is not private, it does change the way we behave online. If you knew that there was somebody over your shoulder who you really respected, who was watching everything you do online, I think you'd behave. Now, what's sad about that is there actually is somebody. God is watching everything you do. But that doesn't seem to be a powerful enough incentive for many of us. But if it's your best friend down the street or the deacon in your church or your pastor, you sure don't want him getting that accountability report. So I think there's a sense in which our – and then when you say public, and you mean in the house, a room like the den, someplace where we actually would do this. We would have a desk in our family room that is positioned in such a way that the computer screen faces the kitchen.
So
no matter what you're surfing, you're going to see what it is. And our kids also know that mom and I get a report that tells us what everyone's surfing every day. And that is helpful in terms of protecting.
Yeah.
But in the end, it's going to come down to, because once they leave us, these safeguards we put in place ourselves voluntarily because we know they have value. How do we convince our kids, though, that those safeguards – either they should install for themselves when they're gone from us, or they should just avoid – I mean, it's at some point we have to release them.
Right. I think we talk about why we do it and why as adults we've chosen to do it in our home and what the dangers really are of not having that accountability. I've heard a man once who had an internet addiction with pornography, and he said, I just can't stop doing it. And someone asked the man, well, what happens if your wife would walk in the room right when you were doing it? He goes, I'd stop doing it. So, well, you can if you have the accountability. And so showing the value of if you know someone's watching you.
Yes, it changes everything.
And so teaching our teens not to trust themselves, to have a healthy distrust for their own vulnerability, to know that they are vulnerable and take heed lest who is standing lest you fall, and just say, you know, I at 45 years old or 40 years old, I am having accountability. I am having protections in my life. How much more do you need them when you're 18 years old?
Sure.
Helping them to see the value of it and to seek it out for themselves. Ideally,
I often wonder if it's just an issue too of every time that you do something, if it's that or if it's anything you're doing that you think you're able to do privately, you can cuss when no one's in the room with you, whatever you think this thing is.
Right?
Is it because we have a really sincere doubt are we betraying the kind of the true nature of our faith that we think. You know, do we really live in such a way that we recognize the all-present holy creator that we say we believe in?
Right.
But when I'm given a chance to do something in private, do we just think, oh, well, God will forgive me for that at some point. He knows my struggles. How do we I see all the time that young kids will find one way or another to justify these behaviors But like you said, if there's no way to justify them without mom or dad seeing you do it, that is, at least while you're in the house preparing your kids to go to college, yeah. that is a strong –
Well, I think that's also – there could be a weekly accountability meeting with a dad and a son, for example, and saying, hey, have you seen anything this week that bothered your conscience and the computer and your phone? And creating an environment that's grace-saturated where it's, okay, you stumbled. Now let me help you and not – you know, condemn you for it, but let me help you to be stronger. But I think sometimes teens are embarrassed, or they struggle with it, and then they're ashamed to bring it out. But really, once they bring it out, all of a sudden the grace of God floods them, and they have the strength to overcome it. But if they just hide it, it becomes harder and harder to fight it. So some kind of accountability with an older person who has lived through those years and has overcome those temptations and is now practicing walking with God in that area to help them to do the same thing.
You know, and we're getting close to the end of our time together, but I wanted to be able to kind of move in this direction as we end. This idea of having somebody in your life who you feel that good about, I often talk about the fact that it's been powerful for me when I was raising my teenagers to have someone in their life mm-hmm. who was considerably younger than I am, mm-hmm. but held my worldview. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they would get what I would have said about the issue, mm-hmm. but they get it from a much cooler, younger, right. hipper version right. of the guy who can snowboard and wakeboard and will take them snowboarding and wakeboarding and do all those things that maybe I don't do. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I actually had a young guy who's been very important in my own life, who I maybe in some small way also helped mentor. He's about 15 years younger than I am, but he's between me and my boys.
Right.
So he's able, you know, he's 10 years older than my boys. So he's able to, you know, they see him differently.
Right, right.
He's much cooler than I am, right. But he holds my worldview. Right. There's a value, I think, for us as parents to find those mentors for our young people who share our view of the world. And sometimes right. that's a youth pastor,
yep.
or it's a youth worker, yep. or it's somebody, you know, it's your cousin, it's your cousin's son, it's somebody in the family.
Yeah.
Is that approach, have you seen people adopting that approach in their
own kids? Yeah, I think the studies have shown this, that a teen is more likely to practice the faith when they're an adult if they've seen it modeled in a multiplicity of relationships. So not just mom and dad, but like you said, a youth leader or somebody that 5-10 years older than them who's living out the faith in the context of their personality, in the context of their callings, in the context of their responsibilities, with a different personality, with a different style, but they're seeing the same worldview lived out. The more adults that know them and that love them and that show and model the faith with them, the more likely they are to practice that faith when they're older, because they'll see that it's real, that they can build their life on it.
That makes sense. Now, what do we do? How do we help our kids then when they go away to college and they're not with us anymore?
Right.
And I see this all the time. I get asked to come on college campuses and speak at things like Ratio Christi, which is a apologetics-based organization that's really there to help students navigate the objections to Christianity and from a very, you know, philosophical perspective. But I also get a chance to speak with Campus Crusade for Christ, which is really more about connectivity. You know, it's about relationships. It's about connecting. So, and that's so important. So how do we help our young people to be connected once they're away from us and they're on the college campus?
Well, I think if they come from a churched home, it's easy to take for granted Christian friends. I know that I did growing up. And so you have Christian friends at your church or your youth group, and you think, well, this is normal. This is – and you kind of default. This is your default. But you go to secular college, and you're not going to have those friends unless you go out of your way to make them. So I think you need to help. We need to help our teenagers understand the value of friendships, the value that friends. You know, Proverbs 13:20 says, "He whoever walks with the wise becomes wise, but a companion of fools will suffer harm." The idea that if you walk with wise people, you'll become wise. Now that teen may, at 16 years old, be walking with wise people by default, but not intentionally, not having thought through
that's
it.
Good point.
So you help them think through. Hey, look at your friend Johnny and Danny, and how they help you. How they've been a great help in your life. When you get to college, you really want to find people like that.
Yeah, so basically what you're saying is when our students are younger and they're with us, because we happen to saturate them in an environment, they make no effort at all, and they happen to have Christian friends.
Right, right.
But now you're going to be in a saturation environment with maybe there still could be a lot of Christians there, but you're not – unless you make the effort to seek them out.
Right.
And this is one of the issues, I think, even – not just in you know, same-sex – not same-sex, but I mean if you're a guy and you're looking for guy friends at college, you get to kind of seek those out. But also your prospective mate, the person you might meet who become your wife or become your husband.
Right.
This is – I mean the odds of this happening unless you're intentional about finding the group that reflects your worldview.
Right.
You could go the entire 4 years and never meet somebody in the university who reflects your worldview, who shares it,
right.
that you find it might be a compatible might be compatible for marriage.
Right.
And I know this is not, you know, kind of the reason we go to college, but let's face it, you're going to spend 4 years in those critical years from 18 to 24, 18 to 22, and you're going to be in this location. So what strategies then? So what are you telling parents how to be intentional? Are you just saying, hey, seek out the Campus Crusade groups, or what are you telling them?
Well, I think find a church and a campus ministry before you even go to the college. That when you go visit the college, show your teen – help your teen understand the importance of finding a Christian community by saying, hey, let's go visit classes and let's stay the weekend and go to this church on Sunday morning. And let's go meet for lunch with this guy over here who's the campus minister at this school and get to know him. Now when the kid chooses that college and he goes there, he knows that John, the campus pastor, is going to be looking for him. He has a name and a face of somebody on that campus that he has met before, and he knows I'm not alone here. At least they have John. John will help me meet more people.
Right, right.
And they have some. I think when you go and you're a total stranger, it's hard to say, okay, Sunday morning, do I wake up early? How do I find the church?
I absolutely experienced with my son. One of my sons was at university and just trying to. Luckily, I knew somebody who from my youth group was local to the campus who could kind of get him to the where he's supposed to go, because otherwise, you're absolutely right. Not only will
the
you
inertia.
Not make the, exactly it's yeah. inertia because yeah. you won't make the effort, and then 6 months have gone by and you still haven't plugged in. How many parents do you think, though, that's a great idea, but how many parents do you think actually kind of see that as part of the strategy for picking a university? Hey, one of the things we're going to decide here is academics. Does it have the program you want? Is it, you know, can we afford it? Is it, you know, where is it at geographically? But does it have a strong Christian ministry and local church? That's that second part's hard.
Yeah.
Because not every campus that has a strong Campus Crusade, let's say, or InterVarsity, or whatever it may be, is necessarily going to have a strong local church, especially like the junior colleges. I mean, you're not necessarily going to have even a if it's not a college town, quote unquote, there may not be a college church.
Yeah.
So how do you overcome the obstacles of trying to find that church? How do you even begin?
Well, I think you talk to your friends in your denomination. Maybe talk to your pastor and say, hey, who do you know in San Francisco or Bakersfield or wherever your kid's thinking about going to college, wherever the college is. Say, who do you know in that area that is a pastor of a good church? Going on the internet, looking for sermons there, looking for what churches believe. Talking to friends and family that might know people in that town, trying to find at least one or two people they can talk to when they get there. I think they do. I advocate in the book for three things when you're looking for a college. Look for academic quality, job preparation, and Christian community. Those three, I think, are essential to the college experience. You're paying enough money that it's so crucial, and you're paying a lot of money to be there. You want to have all three of those things be there. Because when you graduate, you want to have been well-prepared academically. Yeah, you want to have job preparation, job prospects, sure. But you also want to have had a faith community, because if you don't have a faith community in college, you might not be a Christian when you graduate college. You may not have walking with God in any sense of the world when you graduate. And so I think it's so crucial that we help our teens assess the college and assess the Christian environment at that college. And like you said, there are lots of Christians at UCLA or UC Berkeley or these large state schools. You just have to know how to find them. They're in campus organizations. They're in churches in the area. So be proactive before you even get there.
Great place to stop. I really appreciate, Alex, you taking the time to come with us today to take us on this little journey. On this book, you've written a great book for students and for parents who are preparing their kids to go to college called Preparing Your Teens for College, Faith, Friends, Finances, and Much More. Alex Chediak, written and published by Tyndale. Get out there and get this. You'll find this to be a fabulous resource, especially as we're getting to the season of graduations. Thanks so much for joining us this week here at Stand to Reason. Jim Wallace sitting in for Greg. See you back here next week. Go out there and give them heaven.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.